Welcome aboard. It's episode 47 of the J.R. Heff Show. And once again, it's our weekly current events conversation, Shouting Along the James with Norm Leahy. Norm.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening to you. So it is, again, a current events program, which means that we are doing a, snapshot of history as it happens. And so while we have spoken about Scott Taylor and his petitions in the past, and also about Bill Stanley and his ideas for how to use $3 billion of the state's money, taxpayer money, on schools, they bear discussion because news has been made about those two items this week. So let's go with the court decision. Let's start on that, because you've also written a column, as have I, on Taylor's unforced error. What are your thoughts about, first of all, describe for the audience, if they haven't heard about it already, the court's ruling and what your thoughts are on it?
Well, it was at Richmond Circuit Court on Wednesday. Case was heard regarding the validity of signatures filed on behalf of Sean Brown to get on the ballot in the second congressional district. Several hundred of those signatures had been put under challenge, all of them circulated by members, allegedly volunteers, of Mr. Taylor's campaign staff. Now, without getting too deep in the weeds, the upshot is, how many cliches can I string together? But the judge basically blew his stack, say that this was a out-and-out fraud. But in his decision, he said the court is satisfied that every petition circulated by the five individuals, they were all Taylor staffers, was done so with the intent to defraud the Commonwealth and its election officials. The court strikes every petition page circulated by these individuals, which totals 600 signatures. In other words, Sean Brown's off the ballot. This judge thinks fraud was committed, and the ongoing Virginia State Police and Roanoke Commonwealth Attorney investigation into this may actually end up resulting in indictments somewhere down the road. Mm-hmm. What political effect this has, we don't know, because as far as I can see, maybe you've seen differently, there's only one poll, and it was from April on the second district race, and it was a hypothetical matchup.
Yeah.
Even then, it was a close race.
So I got a couple of points on this that need to be made, and the first is the fact that second district, everybody knows it's the highest concentration of military. Everybody knows that you've got Navy versus Navy here. Okay, so you have a Navy commander, retired Navy commander versus a former Navy SEAL. And as a former naval officer myself, I'm well aware of the code of ethics that the Navy has. We have this thing called our core values, and the most recent being honor, commitment, and courage. If you're a little bit more old school, it's tradition, integrity, and professionalism. And so if you look at the word honor and you look at the word integrity, when a judge says you have committed out-and-out fraud, that does not bode well in terms of the honor code regarding Scott Taylor. So that's point number one. Point number two, if you're going to say Taylor is going to be saved by the fact that he's voted 97% of the time with Trump, you missed the Mary Jones versus Scott Taylor primary. the simple fact of the matter is that there are a lot of Republicans down here who feel disaffected by Scott Taylor, who feel that his words, not his actions, matter more. And I do not see them running down to the polls to cast their ballot for Scott Taylor when they might, tolerate an Elaine Luria for 2 years, knowing that in 2020, a presidential election, they can just boot her out as a first-timer and perhaps Mary Jones running with Trump on the ticket.
That assumes Trump is on the ticket.
Yeah, which we're going to get to later on down the road. But you get my gist here that Taylor's got this twofold problem. Number one, he doesn't have really Trump supporters in his corner. Number two, he probably just alienated a significant portion of his veteran and active duty Navy support as well with this. It's going to be tough sledding for him. But then again, you know, hey, maybe everybody will just forget about all that and, you know, say, well, I got to vote for the conservative.
Well, and you and I both know that there are several people who will do that. They would, it's the old voting for the yellow dog syndrome over somebody of the other party. But the thing that I can't escape is the criminal investigation is ongoing. And the Commonwealth's attorney down from Roanoke has said that he won't release his findings until after the election. So even assuming Mr. Taylor pulls this one out, and it's he can. It's a toss-up race, but he can win. Does he keep the seat? Because if criminal charges come down, that's when deals start getting made, people start flipping, and then all of a sudden, you know, the congressman knew everything about this, and by the way, he helped do this, or whatever you want to suspect. This isn't done.
No, it's not done by a long shot. You also throw into account the civil action that's ongoing. There's a $2.4 million lawsuit regarding the fraudulent signatures. That's going to play itself out over the course of, you know, several months at least. That's definitely going to go into the next term. And then, you know, you just have to take a step back and wonder, you know, there's a special prosecutor in Virginia Beach that's also investigating this. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, this, you and I both realize we're going to the brass tacks, that who this sticks to is ultimately Taylor. Whether he knew about the fraud, which is what we're talking about, him mm-hmm. knowing about the fraud. He knew clearly that he had staffers out there trying to, quote unquote, right the wrong by getting Sean Brown on the ballot. He's said publicly, like, something along the lines like, it's democracy or something like that. So he knew about that. What he is saying he did not know about was, you know, the fraud and the falsification of the signature. So we need to be very clear about that. We also need to be very clear that Sean Brown herself also had missteps with the petition process. She also, you know, used, while she lives in Hampton, she ended up using Virginia Beach addresses on some of the petitions, which she's quoted as saying, you know, was a sophomoric mistake. So she's not out of the woods on screwing mm-hmm. these petitions up either. Mm-hmm. So the reality, though, is what are you and I talking about? You and I are talking about how this affects Scott Taylor. It's not how this affects Sean Brown. You know, Sean Brown, she's off the ballot. It's as simple right. as that. How this affects Scott Taylor is all the optics. And I can't see how it impacts him anything but negatively.
Well, yeah. And ultimately, where you were going, and I'm surprised you didn't say it, is what did Mr. Taylor know and when did he know it? Where is Howard Baker when you need him?
Indeed. It's just a clown show and an unforced error, as I wrote in my column, and I am sure that you wrote in yours. It's you just have to look at it, and you just have to be dumbfounded how an incumbent can effectively gift wrap an election to a candidate. As I mentioned in another interview about this subject, that it's one thing to lose a competitive race based upon the merits or, you know, maybe some of how they maneuver their campaign versus positioning against your campaign. It's one reason to lose that way, to just lose an election, right? It's another one to just basically hand your opponent the election. And that's how I feel Taylor has what he's done here.
Well, it let's just say it doesn't look good right now. Long time to go. And Ms. Luria could yet step in it, too. Who knows? But yeah, right now, election today, I think it would be razor thin either way.
Hmm. You have a greater degree of optimism than I do. But we'll see the polling. And Quentin Kidd, I'm interested. CNU will certainly do this. He has come out and also said that, you know, if Taylor loses the election, he can certainly point to this as the cause. And I think Dr. Kidd is clearly correct in that. Whether it's razor thin or not, we'll see the numbers. Mm-hmm. Talk about this Brown versus Board of Education thing going on. The Roanoke Times wrote an op-ed about it, signaling that we might see Bill Stanley potentially invoke what, you know, invoke some history here as an argument to state why the state should fund the schools. Go into more detail on that.
Well, it's, as I think we've discussed in the past, Stanley is the head of a school facilities subcommittee that right now is currently holding hearings around the state about what he wants to do to try to fix public school infrastructure. Many places, Southside, Richmond, Norfolk, Petersburg, you name it, schools are 50, 60, 70 years older. They're falling down, literally, in some cases. And that's a problem. It's been a festering problem. He wants to try to fix it. One of his solutions he's put out there is, let's have a bond issue. Maybe $3 billion, could be more, based upon potential revenues from internet sales tax collections. However, I've been reviewing a letter that he has sent to the Attorney General, Mark Herring, asking Mark Herring to actually do something besides grandstand. And it is one of the longest letters for an attorney general opinion that I've ever seen. It asks many, many, many questions, and it makes many assumptions. It tells Herring to assume many things. But the upshot, I use that word again, I'm sorry, is the state of Virginia's public education facility, its infrastructure, the school buildings, are some of them so bad that they violate the Supreme Court 1955 Supreme Court ruling in Brown versus Board of Education 2, that and an antecedent that came out of Delaware that essentially said that physical condition of school buildings too could be the equivalent of separate and unequal. He is asking Herring a series of questions about whether there is the possibility, basically, that somebody could reopen this case, take Virginia to court over these school facilities, and win. So he's asking, are there remedies under the U.S. Constitution, the Virginia Constitution, or any other state law? It goes on and on and on. It's going to take time to get an answer for this thing. But it is an interesting approach to the matter. It makes it less of a simple write legislation, put a bond referendum on the ballot, and hope for the best. It's saying that if that doesn't happen, well, you know, gosh, somebody could sue, and then the whole process is taken out of the state's hands and put in a judge's hands, who will decide where the money comes from, where it goes, how it will be spent, and will watch the process for several years. It will be fascinating to see whether Herring answers all of these questions, because he doesn't really have a reputation, at least in my eyes, as somebody who's, let's say, the sharpest lawyer on the staff. Certainly, he has staff lawyers who are extremely good, and I'm sure they'll do all the legwork. But there's a lot of stuff in here that he's going to have to go through and answer, and to basically find out, is the state vulnerable to legal challenge over these school facilities? And I don't know. Maybe. But we'll find out. We'll find out what Herring says.
For folks to kind of get an idea as to just some more basic information regarding where a person lives and what choices people have in terms of where to send their kids to school, I encourage them to listen to a couple of podcasts that we've done, that I've done recently. One is with Dr. Richard Sander of UCLA. He teaches law and economics there. And he wrote a book about moving toward integration in terms of how desegregating actually really improves the quality of services that government offers, which is kind of a little bit of what we're discussing here. And also this week, we had the interview with Jason Bedrick of EdChoice, who is director of policy, regarding school choice initiatives and how, you know, having that mobility, having that freedom to be able to choose the school that you go to also improves the quality of education. So those are two informative podcasts that will help as this discussion goes forward, and these questions that are being posed to the Attorney General get answered, maybe. That will help you formulate a better understanding of what's being discussed about your taxpayer money and about how we as a people solve these complex problems. I'm not saying that Bill Stanley's initiative is wrong, but I will say that, you know, anytime you want to take $3 billion of taxpayer money and claim that it has to be redistributed because, you know, there's a violation of equal protection, you know, that's big government right there.
They're arguing here it's in the law that it has to be done.
Exactly.
And they're also arguing that successive generations of Virginia legislators, governors, education professionals have ignored this issue.
Right.
And because, as we both know, when budgets get tight, what gets cut first? Maintenance. So maintenance has been cut, and it's been ignored, and it's been patched until eventually you have places that and the Roanoke Times has done a very good job on this, detailing things in Southwest Virginia where school walls are separating from foundations, where not only do the roofs leak, but the windows are falling off the buildings.
But making the argument that it's specifically racially motivated, I think is a little bit difficult because...
This isn't have to deal with race at all. It happens to be in a case like Richmond, where the overwhelming majority of children in public schools are African American. The exact opposite is in places like Lee County.
That's my point, which is why citing Brown 2, which was a case about race specifically, I think that somewhat undermines the Goldman argument, the Stanley argument. But we'll see. We will see. I just, saying that we must spend our taxpayer money equitably across all school systems, et cetera. I get the argument, but it's a big government thing. And Senator Stanley can prove me wrong. That's fine. But we'll see. That's just my gut reaction to it right now, Norm. That's it.
Yeah. And I think he approaches it is that this is a government responsibility the government has ignored. And it's not that the money will be distributed equitably. It will be going to address the biggest problems first.
Yeah.
And then they'll see what they can do. So there's this is just an opening act on this whole thing. I think the Herring legal opinion angle is interesting. I think their best bet, however, is to try to get a bond referendum to the General Assembly to make the political arguments, because ultimately this is a political question.
Correct.
But if it does turn out there is also a legal facet to it as well, that gooses the political action. And, you know, the plain fact of the matter is a lot of Democrats don't want to do this. And they want that money. They want all the money to go into roads.
Mm-hmm.
Roads. That's what their constituents get. We want roads. And I get it. I do. Especially Northern Virginia Democrats who signed on to the McDonald Transportation Bill in 2013. They were told that new internet sales tax money would go toward roads. This wants to take some of that money and put it towards school infrastructure. They're not keen on that because they already made their deal and they want to stick by it. So it's sort of an existential question for Democrats. What do you want to do? Schools or roads?
How much money do you of government money do you want to spend as opposed to, you know, holding it back and using it for future needs or whatever? At least it's a discussion though that we can have and we can make as a community, and it's not a superfluous, nonsensical conversations about petitions.
Yeah, I mean, this one actually affects kids in schools, so right. As opposed to a politician and his dreams of higher office.
Exactly. So, this is a real conversation, and it's a good one. And again, looking at Sanders' argument regarding moving toward integration and looking at Bedrick's argument regarding school choice, trying to figure out how all these things together make good policy, make tasty sausage. let's do this. And I'm interested in having the conversation and seeing if the Attorney General actually does his job. So,
that's the most interesting thing to watch for is what does he do?
Exactly.
What does he do? Does he punt? I would wager a nickel that he's going to punt on a lot of this stuff.
So we're not national pundits by any stretch of the imagination. Well, maybe you are. You're pretty close writing for the Washington Post, but I am certainly not. And I guess I just find it amusing to see, mere days after the McCain memorial, that someone from the inside of the administration anonymously writes this op-ed to the New York Times that says, never mind Trump, there are people on the inside that are still making the government work. Much to the president's chagrin. I don't know how to feel about that, to be honest.
Yeah, and of course, people immediately ran to their partisan foxholes on this. Some saying it was the greatest thing printed since the Bible. Others saying it's treason. Others being the president himself.
Yeah, of course.
I think for the New York Times, it fits their wheelhouse. They want to take a swing at the president. What better way to do it than to get somebody from on the inside to anonymously take a swing? Does it tell us anything that we haven't heard before? No. Does it? It fleshes out a little bit more the discussions internally about possibly invoking the 25th Amendment and removing the president as unfit.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would have been extraordinarily dangerous. Mm-hmm. I think that whole amendment is rather questionable. But then again, you got to remember that, Woodrow Wilson did have that stroke and his wife ran the government for about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and the whole thing about the anonymity, some people fixate on that. That doesn't bother me so much. You and I, as old bloggers, kind of chafed against pseudonyms and anonymous folks because it always struck me as a little bit of a cowardly thing to do. But at the same time, there are plenty. History is rife with examples of people writing things anonymously to make a point, and having them appear in print. The Federalist Papers immediately leap to mind.
Right.
So does George Kennan's famous memorandum signed Mr. X. Mm-hmm. That led to the policy of containment. So it's not unprecedented. So please spare me those arguments. But what does it say about the president? I'm much more interested in seeing Bob Woodward's book come out. Woodward does tape everything. He's some people are immediately elevating him to Gutenberg or Benjamin Franklin. He is an excellent reporter, no question about it. But this whole episode reminds me of another book that he wrote with Carl Bernstein, The Final Days. Have you read that?
I have not yet.
Yeah. You want to talk about people in the White House running things while the president is obsessive on something else or disassociated, maybe drunk? Read The Final Days. And you read about how Al Haig basically kept the plates of the White House spinning while Nixon was falling into his well of despair before his resignation. So that too, not unprecedented, but that same kind of thing, deep reporting, it's going to be devastating.
Well, we will stay tuned and see what happens. And, I guess just as political observers, we're just going to keep on trucking along. There's not really much that we can do other than see how this stuff plays out. I'm surprised that maybe I shouldn't be, but I'm presuming certainly after the midterm elections there are going to be some Republicans who are going to be announcing their challenge to the administration. It is not a coronation, and it never should be, even with an incumbent. You know, we've kind of gotten into this mode that it is. But if you look back in history, there have been plenty of challengers to incumbent presidents. Doesn't mean that they win, but at least there, you know, there's a conversation and a convention.
Yeah, you don't even have to go back that far.
No, you really don't.
Go back very far at all. Remember Pat Buchanan winning New Hampshire against George H.W. Bush, Reagan's challenge to Gerald Ford, Ted Kennedy's challenge to Jimmy Carter, on and on and on. So, yeah, not unprecedented. And those who say, well, I, though, am a little bit skeptical whether any of the current crop of seat warmers will challenge.
Yeah, it's going to I wonder if we're going to have a leader. And, you know, I'm not going to make any bones about it. I'm not particularly a fan of the tone and tenor that comes from the White House. You know, and you got to shake your head, and you certainly hope that in terms of foreign policy and trade, that the president does not create a catastrophe for the country. So, you know, I find it just week to week, we're just kind of holding our breath regarding what's going to happen. So,
yeah, well, I guess you can put your MAGA hat away then, Jim.
I don't believe I ever had one. I just want free markets, free people, and for us to focus on our liberty and our personal responsibilities. That's
so you wrote the
op-ed. Pretty simple. I could have written the op-ed, yes. Unfortunately, I don't have a high-level place within the administration. But it certainly echoes a lot of my thoughts. I agreed with much of what was written in the op-ed, for sure.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it shakes out. I think the book will do more damage. But, you know, we've been at inflection points, tipping points, points of no return so many times since 2016. I've become jaded whether this will do anything serious long-term.
So you can find him at @Norm_Leahy on Twitter, and also his columns on The Washington Post. All of them are right there for you to see through the link in the show notes. I am on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at J.R. Heft. And of course, my op-eds can either be found at the Princess Anne Independent News, princessanneindy.com, or right here on jrheft.com. Until next week, Norm.
We'll talk then.
Sounds good. We're shouting along to James. Take care.